Welcome to the El Arpa podcast, the home for cultural chit-chat in and outside Madrid. People will talk. Welcome to the third edition of the El Arpa Coronavirus Quarantine Special Podcast number 3. And joining me on a balcony in the posh part of Madrid is the ballet buttery Mary. How's it going? Every week, another suspect introduction.
Yeah, I have to say, I think probably the most accurate thing of all those was ballets, which is quite worrying.
Exactly, yeah. Well, I've heard on good authority, I was speaking to one of the lads, and he was telling me there's nothing wrong with doing ballet because a lot of footballers do it. And in fact, a lot of the exercises he was doing was Pilates. He was accidentally doing Pilates, and, you know, he never knew
accidentally.
It. So. Yeah, as in, like, he's just doing exercises for different things, and then he discovered
and then it happened.
Yeah.
Then he realized he was doing Pilates.
He looked down, and he's wearing leg warmers, and no recollection of how they got into his legs. Yeah, that's what happens. He just kind of came to and realized where he was. No, he just realized he was doing these exercises, and then, like, somehow he found out that this was actually part of a Pilates program. And basically, you know, a lot of routines that he would do or athletes would do would fall under the umbrella of either ballet or Pilates or something like that, you know?
But there are a lot of men that do Pilates and it's nothing like that. It's like I did it last year and it's very demanding.
I know, yeah.
It's not like dance at all. But anyway, why were you looking for a... support for your ballet activities?
I wasn't. I'm a modern man, and I don't need confirmation or reinforcement from another male. So there. But you have. Well, you've really landed me in it this time, haven't you?
What with this time?
You suggested I email Irish filmmakers who are trying to document Irish people in Madrid living through the COVID-19 experience. And you know what? I listened to you and they accepted me. So I'm going to have to film this in some way. I mean, I'm not really sure how this is going to work. I have to film it when I wake up. This is the thing, though. You see this in YouTube videos. And, like, obviously, YouTubers do this when they wake up. But they're really awake already. They've set up the camera, obviously. So it's all reenactment. It's all fake, you know. So I'm going to have to, like, join that kind of those ranks and you know, stage my waking up. And then
you can say you're going to have to while you have this, like, massive smile because you're very happy that you're going to do it. So sound like it's been imposed by me.
Well, the thing is, though, I mean, I'm not sure if they expect a certain technical level, so I'll have to, like, find out more about it and see if, with the equipment that I have in the house in the quarantine, that I can do it. And I'm not going to put anybody at risk by asking for delivery people to deliver microphones or anything like that. I would not do that. So what we can do is, yeah, but also, you know, that could turn out well. It could be an interesting thing. Because I saw the in the paper some Irish people talking about Madrid. And we spoke about this, Madrid during the coronavirus. So I'll be trying to avoid these particular things, okay? I'll be trying to avoid, one, Madrid is a city of fiestas, and now the party is over. I'll be trying to avoid that.
Thank God for that.
Now the city has been plunged into a semi-permanent siesta, something like that, you know? Also the feria. So I think, yeah, whenever you have a foreigner talking about Spain, it's always the football, the fiesta, the siesta, and the cerveza. To be fair, beer sales have gone up dramatically in Spain. I'm assuming in other countries under quarantine as well. And if you order from Deliveroo, you do get free latas or cans of beer as well. And three bottles.
But you would never put anybody at risk, so you wouldn't know that.
No, I'll be honest. I do try to limit it. I did get one Deliveroo, but it's a no contact delivery, so they leave the food outside your door, and then you leave them going to the elevator or whatever, or go down the stairs, and then you open the door and you just pick it up. So, like, age are you? Contact with that person. And you know, as we discussed last week, I think from the Monday of this week, a lot of things in the city were closed down. Even stricter measures were put in place. Non-essential jobs were, you know, you couldn't do them basically. But these food delivery riders are seen as essential staff, because it's not always possible to go to the supermarket or get the things that you want. And food is a necessity. So I don't know. I mean, obviously you disagree with me strongly here, but
no, but I think the most important part, I mean, there's still a service because there are people that cannot cook, and you know, and disabled people, for example, that need help as well. So a lot of them like rely on organizations bringing them and delivery takeaways are playing a part in that as well. So that's important.
Well, you know, just for the benefit of the listener, I am taking the lockdown very seriously. You know, you probably saw this on Irish Twitter as well today. Some poor woman was talking about going to her father's funeral. And do you see this tweet?
No? I keep on seeing these tweets, and it's just really
depressing.
Really sad. Yeah.
Well, she was saying that 20 people could only attend, and they were sitting 2 meters apart. And she was making the point that because she never thought she would have to suffer this type of experience. And there's people in the country who in Ireland who aren't taking it seriously. I think most people probably aren't taking it seriously, but you do get people who are not. And I've heard stories of especially kind of younger people running up and coughing in people's faces, and go. And I even heard of one incident of people, like these people going around Tesco's and coughing in people's faces, making a big joke out of something that's very serious. So it beggars belief, you know, that kind of mentality. But I even know somebody whose relative passed away as well, and only one person from the family was allowed to attend. So that'll give you a picture of what the restrictions are in Ireland. You know. One person represents the family, but it's very restricted in what you can do. In other senses, you are allowed to leave the house for limited exercise, which is not possible here in Madrid. But you know, it's a global response, and in different countries the responses are a little bit different. So you know, that's the coronavirus. Got a bit serious there, but it is a serious situation. But on happier things, you were very surprised on Sunday last. You sent me a link to a newspaper article. What was that newspaper article about? Do you remember?
Do you mean about our book?
Oh, that? Yeah, that's what I mean. So would you like to explain more? I mean, this is within El Confidencial. No guesses for for guessing.
Which is a reputed newspaper. It sounds really like random, like, you know, there's a spy holding, making holes for his eyes with it, but no.
No, it sounds like a gossip newspaper or something, like.
Yeah, no, it's actually like, finance focused newspaper, or yeah, I don't know. But our book feature there, of course, there's been a lot of fake news regarding coronavirus, and so, you know, the article just picked on that and how it's been like that since ancient times, which is basically what our book says, and nowadays is kind of like an extension of our book finished with the anti-vaccine movement, and now it's kind of like on to the coronavirus globally. So, I mean, people keep saying to us, you know, that we should do a second part with all that is happening these days.
No, not a second part. I think what I'd love to do is like an update edition, now a new chapter and revised introduction.
Like twice the size.
Well, the thing is, what was I going to say? Well, first of all, nobody would find fake news a stimulating topic to read about, but you know, there's proof that they do, and I had to like convince you to keep writing the book in the whole process. Do you remember those days?
No.
I'm only joking. That's why. But no, what I wanted to say was like one fascinating element of this discussion, and I haven't seen much of it in the papers, is the anti-vaxxers' response to COVID-19. Because,
oh, they're very quiet now, aren't they?
Oh, they certainly are. I watched a documentary before this all kicked off, and it's like these families that were really against it, and their arguments were basically rubbish you know, no science behind it at all. And yeah, I just wonder how they're dealing with this now, if they've maintained their belief in this, or if they've maybe changed their minds. But yeah, so I haven't seen much coverage of it. But obviously, when it comes to newspaper articles as well, the best part are always the comments. My favorite comment was, it looked like it was going to be an interesting article, but it's just just more propaganda for another book. And, you know, he has a point.
I mean, it was insightful.
And then one comment about the Reichstag fire, who did it? The lefties, apparently, according to some of the commentators. And then one guy who was talking about, if your child tells you a lie, is that fake news? And are they really taking drugs? I don't know. I kind of lost track of that one. But, you know, all that aside.
Yeah, but comments on newspapers, they're always manic, really.
Well, I was surprised by that detail, actually, because to be honest, there's only 5 comments. And, like, if you see things in the Irish Times, which would be probably... Well, actually, I'm not sure which one is the biggest selling paper in Ireland, actually, to be honest with you. But the Irish Times would certainly be up there. And it wouldn't have a lot of comments underneath the articles, generally, unless it was something that was really topical, maybe something.
Guys, like, just think on.
And then like
everybody comments on everything.
Yeah, but in the Guardian though, it's you get hundreds. I mean, get 700 comments and things. You know, so I think they are definitely the most commented on newspaper. Maybe I haven't seen the other ones really online, but I was just kind of surprised that there's only 5, and it is a very well regarded and well read newspaper. So, well, it's a nice honor anyway, no? And the first video for that YouTube thing that we've been doing, and it's pretty cool, no? You're happy with it?
Yeah, I am pretty happy. I think it's pretty cool. And we'll see it, like, soon enough. The public
You don't have to give specifics. You can tell me after the podcast, but is it due relatively soon? I can't remember when they're uploading the first one.
Well, like 4, so probably this weekend, because we're on the full script already.
It's true. Oh, we just finished one today. It's a doozy. It's a fantastic one. Very interesting. But we won't give any more information. We dodged several bullets in the last podcast. So let's just take a break from that and not touch any controversial issues. But, you know, our ballet chat was a bit of a hit last week as well. You've done an extended, more intense ballet workout this week. Can you walk us, Mary, if you're not too sore?
I was gonna say I'll dance you through that. it was good. I think the other day we had different experiences because I did one which in the end happened to be a special stretching edition, which led me to think that that's mostly what you did and you don't squat and things like that, which didn't really match what I'd done. But then a couple of days ago I caught it on a normal day and then it was more similar to what you said. At first it was a little bit irritating because the woman is like overly happy. And well, you know, I'm a grump, so no, but it's just good to have somebody really when it's the first time that you don't really know that well how to do it. It's always good to have someone who's like really positive and stuff like that. And what I like about these workouts that they're putting online these days is that they insist on, like, you know, if it's the first time you do this, don't worry if you cannot do it fully, or they tell you, well, level one you can do this, level two you can do these other things. So that's always nice. What
you're literally saying what I said last week.
So,
okay. I can't believe you're plagiarizing me to my face on my own podcast.
What do you mean on your own podcast? Excuse me?
Okay.
Last time I checked, it was 50%. So I'm just agreeing with you.
I know we've never discussed it, but I assume I had a 51% controlling stake in the podcast.
Since when?
Since the first one, but okay. Again, this is something that we can talk about after the quarantine's over. We can have a legal meeting face to face. But we'll touch on one more thing to do with the coronavirus, and then we'll kind of talk about more general culture. But no, I think it's interesting because obviously, you know, we started off talking about this Irish group. They have a project called Life Interrupted, and you know, they want to document the Irish experience in Madrid. So it's kind of like an open thing. It's positive. It's like, well, how are you just living this thing, you know? But we were speaking during the week of like international reactions to the coronavirus, and also because we're living in Spain and you're Spanish, also international reactions to the coronavirus in Spain. For example, you told me during the week there's four countries, I believe, who have given financial help to Spain during the coronavirus, and they're a surprising quartet, aren't they? So who are they again?
Yeah, well, this was like a call that was done to NATO for help, and then three countries from NATO and one which is not from NATO replied. So the one which is not in NATO is Japan, and the other three are Turkey, the Czech Republic and Latvia, which is kind of like a random and so on, say. But I mean, we're very grateful, especially like in contrast with the attitude of some European countries such as the Netherlands, you know, whose government think that we shouldn't really get any aid, Spain and Italy. So, I mean, I think like at the end of the day, this is a real test on Europe again. This is a chance like to show why it is important to have Europe, and so far it's been like pretty disappointing, the response.
Okay, so just a couple more things before we finish today. We've had a very enlightening conversation. So let's top it off by referring to some Arabic movies that we've been watching. They were free on a couple of platforms. And thanks to you, Mary, for finding them, because you did find them and you shared them with me. And we watched it at the same time, albeit in different locations. And we kind of were commenting on the movie, the documentary we were watching through WhatsApp. And so, yeah, long-time listeners of the podcast will probably know that we do like to frequent Casa Arabe in Madrid. And one of our first videos that we did on our now defunct YouTube channel, it was about Casa Arabe. So we're big fans of Arabic culture. So first of all, you know, you have a dog's nose, not literally, for sniffing out culture. How did you come across this? Now you're, yeah. Well,
what?
You're like cranking up your nose there, like a bloodhound.
Because of the dog's nose. Okay, I have to say this was in my making, and my sister sent it to me. So we have to thank my sister for this. Assistance. So yeah, she just sent it to me. She sends me a lot of things, but this one was really up our street. And then we just discovered this platform that is showcasing, I would say, probably mostly Lebanese films, but also Egyptian and other Arab countries. I think at some point it was part of like a Lebanese film festival, but not always. And some of them are short, some of them are long. We've watched two short movies and a long one, haven't we?
We have, yeah. So let's look at the long one maybe first, because that will be the meat and potatoes of this part of the conversation. Or what
the halal meat and potatoes.
I was just going to say, what do like Lebanese people like to eat? Probably not meat and potatoes like we do in Ireland, but and it's also like just the best thing that we saw, to be honest with you. Now the short films are good, and we'll get to them. But effectively, this is the story of a farmer in Lebanon who, you know, when you first meet him, he's tending to his cows. He's drinking some tea or some coffee. He's pottering around his kind of empty house, and it's very interesting. But then as the documentary develops, you get to meet his cousin who fought in the Lebanon war against the Israelis. You get to meet a few other people who were also forced out of the village. And they come back to tend to their garden, you know, because they were forced off the land. And even though they don't live there anymore, they want to come back to it. It calls them. And another couple who come back to pick roses from the house that they abandoned as well, but they still get pulled back to this homeland, to this hearth, you know. And they're Christians. They talk about Christmas. They talk about Easter. And it's just a very beautiful documentary, because what it is essentially is it's two things. One is it's documenting this kind of maybe slower life in this village. I mean, you could describe any village like that, I imagine, but it's kind of detailed and filmed in a very beautiful way by somebody who's related to the main protagonist of the documentary. And also it's about a lost village. You know, it before the war was very vibrant, and it was very, you know, had celebrations and communities coming together. And now these people are kind of bereft because they don't have that anymore, and they're almost stuck wistfully looking backwards through the years to this period before the war, and here they are stuck in the period after the war. And when communities die for whatever reason, I think that sort of melancholy and wistfulness is kind of brought to the fore. No, so that's kind of the basic idea of this documentary. So I can explain why I like it as well, but before I do that though, Mary, I know you did as well. So what are the things that you really enjoyed about this?
I thought it was a very nicely short documentary. It starts very slowly introducing different characters even though there is one main person. But yeah, it follows different neighbors, and it's just it seems to be in very simple terms what the village life is like now that it's been abandoned, but in reality, basically it's kind of like a way of showing what's not there anymore. And what's not there anymore is just told through the stories of the neighbors, you know, through their personal accounts of what happened to the families and the points where they had to leave and so on. So in some way, it just goes to show that the village is the people, and, you know, when the people are gone, when the community is broken, all those things, they just take them away with them.
Yes, it's a very compelling part of it. And you do mention that it's beautifully shot. And yeah, it is, because you get a lot of long takes where, as I mentioned, he's making tea in the start of the documentary and the camera is just focusing on his hands and the details of making this beverage. It's, you know, it's like... it's a documentary, so it's documenting in the truest sense, because even, you know, for example, on Netflix, to go on a bit of a tangent, people are talking about the show Unorthodox, which is a great show as well. And the filmmakers were saying, because a lot of the traditions of the Hasidic Jews are unknown to the outside world, that it gives them a chance to kind of document it almost as if they're making a documentary. And so even though it's a work of fiction, Unorthodox, albeit based on a true story, they get to... It's a piece of semi-fiction, because there's some parts of it that are fictitious and other parts which are true, but ultimately it gives them a chance to kind of document these things as a documentary rather than a Netflix show. And this documentary that we're talking about the Lebanese farmer is true. It's based on his life. It's biographical, and there's a lot of scenes that, you know, where the camera is static and there's not a lot of movement, you're just allowed to linger and absorb the atmosphere. In another scene, he drives off somewhere and the camera just stays in his position, static, and you can see him driving off, getting smaller as he disappears into that distance. And for me, you know, this type of documentary making and filmmaking has a profound effect on me. I really do love it. It's very, very beautiful, because you know, you get to see and feel and get a sense, an unspoken sense of a place through this kind of technique. And you don't crowd the narrative or the scenes with unnecessary narrations or a person on camera who's like presenting this documentary. Everything is as it is. It's very naturalistic, and you get a sense of it in the truest sense. You know, I think that's reinforced by the fact, because I mentioned earlier, that the guy making the documentary is related to the main subject. So everything is kind of personal and up close, and also understood in a sense. Even though, of course, a lot of people there talk about their experiences. Also, they refer to the war, and they do give some amazing insights as well. So there are kind of more direct things as well. But I think it's a very atmospheric documentary, which definitely is to its credit, I think, you know. I mean, yeah. Do you have anything more to say about that kind of stuff?
No, I think it's interesting what you said, because it just sort of like transports you to a completely different type of like watching experience, because, as you said, when there's a person explaining it to you, it's kind of like they're already mediating what you're supposed to think or how you're supposed to feel about it. So in this case, it's like everything is presented and everything is there for you to see. And then you can, you know, it's only like slightly directed by the questions of the filmmaker, which are minimal, to be honest. But the rest of the time, you're just free to interpret and absorb whatever you want. So I think that adds to the quality.
And how as well, it just, you know, it's just this narrative that's connected. It's not a linear narrative in a sense, but it just keeps as you mentioned, it develops in layers, no? So it's like this little circle is like grow bigger and bigger and build on top of each other until you have like this overall story. So it's told very beautifully as well. It doesn't just look beautiful, it's just a story told really well also. And contrasted with that, you know, the heavy musings, you know, you have scenes where he's playing jokes with an egg and having dinner with his family, and a scene where his cousin's like compelling him to marry, and he doesn't want to get married because he has to finish building the outdoor toilet or the indoor toilet, you know. So you know, I mean, it just brings home who these people are. They're just normal people who like having a laugh and a joke, and not too dissimilar from the rest of the world, you know, obviously. And it's just a universal story, but also, as I said, you know, for reasons I've mentioned out before, you get a sense of how Lebanon is, and or this part of Lebanon, and how Lebanon was as well before the war, based on what the characters say. It's also kind of linked to what we were speaking about ourselves, about how different places can be little microcosms, no? Like in a country, you have villages that are their own worlds and cities that are their own worlds, and everybody can experience a war slightly differently, no? I think we kind of see that in the documentary as well, don't we?
Yeah, we mentioned this in comparing it to Spain and the experience of the Civil War that people have had in different areas, and it's true that is very different. I think in this case, this village was on a hill, so they were like they felt like they were being attacked from all directions, so they felt that there was no escape, and their experience was that they had to, there was a point where they had to get away basically and just try to go in whatever direction they could, or in the most obvious direction. But then in the end, they all went different ways, so the community kind of like fell apart. So yeah, at some point there was a moment, not a very precise moment, but they can all just identify that throughout time they just simply had to leave.
Okay, yeah. And overall, an amazing story. So would you like to move on to the two short films?
The two short films, one was about a tape, and the other one, you can refresh my mind because I can't remember.
It's a very interesting one. It's about a woman who is Muslim, and she's calling. She lives in Belgium, and she it's set between the Paris terrorist attacks and just before the ones in Belgium, and there's a climate of suspicion, you know, growing around the Muslim immigrants, and she plays a character who, from her window, observes other immigrants from different countries, and she calls the local council, kind of complaining about them and intimating that they could be plotting something. And we won't give away the ending, but it's shot, again, in a very interesting way. It's just basically her stuck in her apartment, and the camera angles are always from her perspective, looking out the window or peering through curtains and things like that. So again, the story is told very effectively, and also kind of shows the how easy it is to fall into paranoia and what those weaknesses are. Because, for example, she is obviously a Muslim character. I think she's internalized the shame of being maybe a Muslim person at this time, because a lot of right-wing politicians in Belgium and in other countries are blaming them for all these things. So she probably feels sensitive and vulnerable to these things. In the story, somebody writes ISIS either on her car or her apartment door. So she's feeling this persecution, and how she reacts to it is by maybe internalizing it and kind of absorbing it and pointing the finger at other Muslims. And it's done very well, because when she calls the council, she's like saying, oh, this guy's Turk, or he's Iraqi. You know, the nationality changes. There's a scene where a guy is like tying his shoelace, kneeling down behind a bush, and she's like saying, oh, he's hiding behind a tree. And it always ends with the same kind of sentence. I don't know what they're up to, but I feel I feel they're going to do something bad. And I think that's kind of sums up, in essence, what drives this type of paranoia. It's not based on any kind of, you know, real information. It's just like this kind of feeling that comes from fear, probably, and maybe other places as well. So it's an interesting story, shot interestingly as well. I guess as something to watch, as a narrative thing, it maybe not as entertaining as the documentary, but it has important things to say and shows them in a nice way as well. I think you share those sentiments as well, don't you, Mary?
Yes, I do.
Exactly.
It was a completely different topic, but also very relevant, very current. And well, there's an interesting twist that I think it's also like makes you reflect on like some interesting paradoxes or different situations that that occur at the same time from different people. So, well, just watch it because it's not very long and you can see what happens in the end.
Yeah, and also, yeah, the other one with the tapes is fantastic. I mean, again, it's kind of filmed in an interesting way, an interesting kind of concept, maybe not as compelling, you know, just as a story to watch, you know, but a lot of good points to it as well. But again, you were kind of left like, it's good, but maybe not as interesting as the other ones that we've spoken about. Isn't that correct?
Well, I thought it was interesting. It's just it's a different kind of thing, because in reality, there was no images or barely any images. It was mostly about the sound. And I think we spoke about that perhaps it would be enhanced if there was even just like a sound wave graph or something like that when somebody was talking. But I think it was interesting still because it was a record of tapes that were sent, like it was the 70s or the 80s. And this is how people communicated when others were abroad. They send them tapes with songs and it's interesting because when we were discussing the long film and talking about the village, then I remember that the kid, I'm pretty sure one of the songs that he sang referred to the village as well. So it's kind of like a way of talking about homeland is just to refer to like a perfect village.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, I mean, you know, I think the sound is a great device as well. You know, you have to access deeper parts of your brain to kind of conceptualize it, and it engages you in a different way to other stories. And it's also based on the idea that one of them is living in the Soviet Union, so they sing this Russian song to him. And also they sing that by the Rivers of Babylon, which is from that group, I think, who sang Ra Ra Rasputin. I think that's the same group.
Boney M.
I think it's from Boney M.
Yeah, sure.
So, you know, it's, you know, they're using these tape recorders, and it's just beautiful because they're using this technology that gets the job done, and it's just this intersection of all these different cultures as well. And yeah, it's different. You know, you don't see these kind of movies all the time. Likewise with the movie where she's just peering through her window and the curtains and things like that. You know, you don't see those stories being told all the time or being shot like that as well. So ultimately, they're definitely worth a check out. Well, probably now you can access them for free, but we can leave a link to them in the description, and maybe you can find a way of checking them out. So yeah, that was our blast of Arabic culture. It was fantastic to kind of see these different perspectives, and it was definitely a very worthwhile experience. So thank you, and thank you to your sister as well for coming up with them. Okay, so I think that's almost it. In next week's podcast, we're going to talk about dancing like a maniac a little bit more. Because we've discovered the joys of of training to 80s classics. And also we can give a shout out now to some of our listeners. We have listeners in Mexico who seem to be tuning in quite a lot, and also particularly in India. So if you're from India and you've been tuning into this podcast for a little bit, thank you very much. We really appreciate your support, and we send you a big Irish and Spanish hello from the tower of El Arpa Media. So now I think you can tell people where they can find us, can't you?
So you can find us on our blog, irishlifeofmadrid.com. We're on Twitter at El Arpa One, on Facebook, El Arpa Media. And yeah, because you're listening to the podcast, so you've already found our podcast.
Exactly. So, well, wherever you are, I'm sure you're grappling with the coronavirus, COVID-19. So take care, look after yourself, and we'll be back with another coronavirus quarantine special podcast brought to you by Skype. Not by
not
Zoom,
many
anyway.
Left.
Not long left. Yeah. Well, if things, yeah, apparently, yeah, by all accounts, we're in the home stretch now. But we'll see how it develops. Hopefully, it improves and we can leave the house in 2 weeks as planned. But whatever happens, we'll keep you up to date. So thank you so much for tuning into this episode of the El Arpa Podcast. This is me saying good luck.
Me saying bye. I very nearly hung up on you.
The El Arpa Podcast, the home for cultural chit-chat in and outside Madrid. People will talk.